Just before 9 o'clock last night, the jury returned guilty verdicts against all three defendants.
It was absolute shambles, to tell you the truth. Just absolutely ridiculous.
Had blood on his clothing the day after the alleged attack.
On a shallow mud bank in the Fitzroy River.
Basically, I think most of the people who used me were good people.
I think a really important question we need to ask is, how many Indigenous prisoners in Australia are innocent?
This is Curtain, a podcast where we pull back the blinds to shine a light on the darkest parts of our justice system and ask, who are the victims? I'm Amy McGuire.
And I'm Martin Hodgson, a senior advocate for the Foreign Prisoner Support Service. Our producer is Paul Watts, music by Clint Curtis, and produced in collaboration with the Brisbane Indigenous Media Association. And a warning, this series contains the names of deceased peoples and has distressing content that might upset some listeners.
For the past few months, Martin and I have spent every spare minute trawling through the details of the shocking murder of an Aboriginal woman in 1991. For the purpose of this series, we'll be referring to her only as Linda, out of respect for her family. Due to cultural protocol, we also won't be publishing any of her images online, and we also ask that our listeners respect the family's wishes as well.
Four people were convicted over her death the next year. That was 1992. Only one of them pled guilty. And when we say spare, we mean it. We've spent hours reading, talking, researching, everything we could think of that would transport us back to the events of one night, a quarter of a century ago.
So I guess at this point you'd be asking, why on earth would you decide to delve back into this case? It was a question I asked myself, and there was a lot of hesitation on my part as well. One, as an Aboriginal woman, and two, as someone very concerned about the rates of family violence within our communities. So why now? And why? Haven't there already been convictions? Haven't they served their time? What's the point? Well, to answer that, I have to give you a little background. Earlier this year, Martin joined me on the daily Aboriginal current affairs show Let's Talk, where I interviewed him about his work overseas. Although he's based in the small New South Wales town of Bega, 2 hours from Australia's capital of Canberra, Martin has for years worked to help overturn wrongful convictions all around the world. He has experience working with Australians. Some of his most high-profile clients have been David Hicks, locked up without trial in Guantanamo Bay, and Peter Grester, the Australian journalist who was jailed in Egypt. But he also has spent a great deal of time helping overturn wrongful convictions for inmates on death row in America, where they have a culture of wrongful convictions. In fact, last year, a new record was set. In 2015, 149 people in 29 states had their convictions overturned. Although the details were different, the commonalities between these people went beyond mere innocence. Many of the men were black, and all of them were poor. And something Martin said that day caught my attention.
So the legal system is very much stacked against poor people, and that's why death row in America is poor black men and poor white men, and that's why prisons in Australia are filled predominantly with poor white people, but overwhelmingly with Indigenous people, because there are no funds to run the cases how they deserve to be run and to have the lawyers that are needed. Based on everything we've just discussed, I think a really important question we need to ask is, how many Indigenous prisoners in Australia are innocent?
That was Martin in April this year, in an interview with me for Let's Talk. That passage immediately stood out to me because a name, that of a man who had been locked up for 25 years, started bleeping through my head like a siren. That name was Kevin Henry. It was a name that kept coming up as I pondered the question, how many Indigenous prisoners in Australia are innocent? We certainly have the same problem here with locking up blackfellas at rates that beggar belief, and many of them go to court with advice to plead guilty. So we have a situation over here where many Aboriginal people are locked up despite not having adequate legal representation. Is it that much of a stretch to believe that the culture of wrongful convictions so prevalent in the United States could be a reality on our own shores? And so after the interview, I rang Martin back.
Hello.
Oh, hi, Martin. It's Amy. In that phone call, I told Martin about a Gurungurung woman named Yasmin Johnson, who had been Kevin's advocate for the past decade while he'd been in prison. She had called me 2 years earlier while I was at another media outlet to raise attention about his case.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd definitely look at it. He's still in prison and it happened back in the early 90s.
Yeah. So it's the reason I always thought there was something in it is because I just asked around, you know, and it his name just keeps popping up. And I just think, you know, it's worth looking back. I don't know if there's anything in it, but I just thought it would, I think you'd be the person who'd find something in it if there was something to be found.
Yeah, no worries. I'm happy to check it out and see if there's anything there. I mean, these old cases, it can be very hard to get any information, but I'll certainly have a look and see what I can find out.
I told Martin that I'd get on to Yasmin, Kevin's advocate, and within a couple of weeks, she had spoken to Martin.
Kevin has had a very rough time and still has a rough time. He's because he's maintained his innocence and, you know, try to do the best he can. You know, we see all these white fellas, cold cases being opened on new evidence and DNA and all this sort of stuff because of new technology. What about the evidence that was presented for his case? Nothing was done about it. There's nothing, no physical, no DNA.
Yasmin told me that Kevin had always maintained his innocence since being convicted in 1992. He'd sent his files to the Innocence Project at Griffith University and to the Aboriginal Legal Service in Brisbane, but there'd never been any movement on his case. I told Yasmin I'd look into it, and I did. Immediately, I was intrigued. I knew there was something here.
Now, that was 6 months ago, and it's taken us that long to get to this point. For the rest of the year, we're going to bring you this story. But it's not just about Kevin Henry. It's also about the memory of an Aboriginal woman and mother who died tragically, far away from her ancestral lands. And in my view, her legacy is worthy of much more. If the wrong person had been convicted over her death, then the justice system, already weighted so heavily against Aboriginal women, could have failed her yet again.
It was the morning of September 1st, 1991. It was, for so many other people in Rockhampton, the major centre of central Queensland, a lazy morning, probably uneventful.
I was living there in Rockhampton too, but I couldn't tell you what I was doing. I was only 3 years old at the time. My Darumbal ancestors, the traditional custodians of the area that's now called Rockhampton, called this waterway Tanubal. It's a significant river for everyone who now lives in this place. The largest catchment along the east coast of Australia. This river also has a bloody history. And this day, there was a new tragedy.
A local fisherman found a naked body on the banks of the Fitzroy River.
Linda was, at this point, been missing for 8 days. She was not from Rockhampton. In fact, she'd only been there for about 2 weeks. Linda was 36 and a mother of four, and she was from South Australia. 7 years prior, her brother had died a violent death in custody. His case was one of the most high profile of the 99 cases investigated by the Royal Commission into Aboriginal deaths in custody. She died 1 year before the Commission handed down its report.
Linda's non-Indigenous husband worked at the local university, but she was more than a wife and a mother. She was also accomplished, a professional. In the 70s, she had set up Port Augusta's first Aboriginal pre-preschool.
But although she'd been missing, there'd been no report that we could find about her disappearance. Linda had a mental illness. It was later reported that she was a schizophrenic. She'd been prescribed medication for a long time, but when she didn't take it, she was prone to wandering.
And it looks like she may have wandered too far from home.
The day after Linda was found, on the Monday, the local newspaper in Rockhampton splashed it across its front page, along with a small, grainy picture of Linda.
Rockhampton police have launched a murder investigation after a woman's naked body was found in the Fitzroy River. Regional Crime Coordinator Inspector Kel Weeks said the woman, 36, was found on the northern bank of the river, 2 kilometres from the city. There were signs of injury. She was identified by relatives late afternoon.
Police from throughout Rockhampton joined a full contingent of detectives yesterday to investigate the woman's death. They were checking several leads.
Linda was found at around 8 that morning. She was on the north side of the river. Now, for the purposes of this podcast, you have to know two things. We'll be talking a lot about the racecourse side of the river and the Tanuba House side. Tanuba House was on the south side and directly faced the racecourse. The racecourse was and still is on the north side of the river. Linda's body was found on the north side. That's on the racecourse side.
Now that day, as investigations were only just beginning into Linda's death, a 22-year-old man by the name of Kevin Henry was picked up by police and thrown in the watch house, along with two other men that day. We'll call them L and C.
They'd all been arrested for public drunkenness and thrown in the watch house.
Now let me tell you about Kevin. He was from Woorabinda, an Aboriginal community situated about 2 hours from Rockhampton. He hardly ever came into Rocky. But for some reason, he was there that day and had been that night as well. It wouldn't have been uncommon for blackfellas to be picked up off the street in Rockhampton, especially those who hung around the riverbank. They were highly visible and overly policed.
While Kevin, L and C were in the watch house, the duty officer at the station turned on the CCTV footage to record. He said that was a standard procedure when more than two people were detained in the watch house.
What happened next is important. In that recording, Kevin allegedly confesses to C that he's killed Linda.
He's supposed to have said, "I killed the C word. I'll show you later how I did it, and I threw her in." The recording, though, is grainy and hard to hear. This is important to note as well, and we'll tell you why later.
Now, regardless of that confession, all the men in the watch house that day, Kevin, L, and C, were let go.
Over the course of the next few days, police investigate Linda's death and then they arrest four people. This is how the local media, the Morning Bulletin, reported it.
Police last night arrested and charged a 22-year-old Rockhampton man with the rape and murder. Police also arrested and charged three women yesterday with the murder of 36-year-old.
The three Rockhampton women, Susan Albury, 28, Amy Saunders, 34, and Margaret Bobb, 28, appeared in the Rockhampton Magistrates Court yesterday charged with murder and causing grievous bodily harm.
The man who was not named was Kevin Henry.
They also call him Curtin.
So what happened the night before Linda died? Where was she that night? And why were all these other people involved? This is the bare skeleton of the story.
The night before she was found in the river, Linda had been at Tanuba House, which literally sits on the banks of the south side of the Fitzroy River. So Tanuba is on the other side of the racecourse. It's a two-story building perched on a hill, and it's still there. It used to be covered in Aboriginal designs and brightly coloured. Now it's painted white with blue trimmings, the site of Rockhampton's yacht club. But even before it was Tanuba House, it had a morbid history. It was the site of the old morgue.
In 1991, Tanuba House was a drug and alcohol rehabilitation centre run by an Anglican charity, Careforce. It was also where a lot of homeless Aboriginal people would sleep, on mattresses under the house, in the full view of the Fitzroy River.
That night, Linda was brutally assaulted, and I must warn our listeners that the details are distressing. Several witnesses saw her being beaten, kicked, jumped on, and having an object inserted into her by the three women, all of them who would later be convicted over her assault.
And by all accounts, it was a horrific assault, and we know that it happened. That's been established. There were several witnesses to the assault. But what happened after is where things get as murky as the brown waters of the Fitzroy. How did Linda end up in the water? And how did she end up 2 kilometres downstream from Tanuba House on the other side of the river?
Well, this is the official version of events. The events confirmed at court by an all-white jury. These details are also distressing, so take that in mind. And also take in mind the fact that Kevin has since backed away from these claims. But this is what came out in court. After the assault, Kevin Henry had dragged Linda to a grassy area where he had raped her and then put her in the water where she had drowned. Drowning was her official cause of death. Those were the details Kevin had given in a confession to police. But for the past 25 years, he's taken back that statement and has continued to maintain his innocence, that he had not committed the crime. And don't worry, we'll talk more about this later in the series. So I guess by now you may be thinking, why would you even take this case on? He's confessed. It's a horrendous murder. Let things be. Let them rest.
Well, it was enough to pique my interest. I've been working on these sorts of cases overseas for a very long time. I've developed a pretty good eye for inconsistencies, and immediately the gaps in the story were glaring. After talking to Yasmin, I immediately began thinking about those title records.
So, Martin, I think the thing that really stood out to me was the fact Linda's body has actually been put in the river, supposed to have been put in the river on the south side, so the Tanuba house side of the river. Yet she's found 2 kilometres downstream. Is it possible she could have crossed the Fitzroy River in relation to the tides? Could the tides have travelled to have pulled her right over to the other side of the river?
From what we've learned looking at the historic tidal records, which are very accurate, it seems obvious to me that there's really only one conclusion, and this is based on more than just my examination of this case, but on years of research into how this occurs, because it's not unusual for a body to be placed in a river once a person's been murdered. And in my opinion, the body was placed on the north side of the river.
Why is that though? What would have happened to her body?
Her body would have travelled directly downstream with the tide, because the tide was high when it was allegedly placed in, or becoming high, and then it ran out for the rest of that time. And that's consistent both with where the evidence says she was put in, where the new evidence I believe exists suggests she was put in, and where her body ended up based on the tidal movement. And there's also a very good clue, but also something testified to in court, which is that there was a parallel line on the north side of the river starting 150 metres upstream from where Linda's body was found all the way to where her body ended up and was discovered that next morning.
So what would have made that parallel line? How would that have been there in the mud?
That would have been caused by Linda's body moving along the bottom as the water ran out. So as the water subsides and runs down the river and you see the narrowing of the river, her body is pushed along the edge and at the same time along the bottom, and that scoured out a parallel line. And what that shows us, that line's 150 metres long, and it remains parallel to the north side of the bank at all times, showing that her body ran in a straight line down the river. There's no diagonal lines, there's no crisscrossing. It's straight from one point on the north side to another point where she's found on the north side.
So if she had been placed in, as you said, around high tide, or as it was getting high tide, couldn't it have been that she was placed on the Tanuba house side, but that she's crossed and then the tide's lowered? You know what I mean, that there wouldn't be that crisscrossing?
It could be a possibility, but we would see those effects continue with the tide, and that would interfere with that parallel line. So while it is possible, it would require an inflow from another river, and we just know that that doesn't exist. So without an inflow and with the parallel line, we have very convincing evidence that the body moved simply in one straight line with the tide, and it was a forceful tide that night.
It was quite a high tide, you were saying.
It was a very high tide. We're talking close to 5 metres. So the force with which it ran out down towards the ocean was very powerful, very strong, and in one continuous direction as it went down the river towards the ocean. And that's played out by both the parallel line that leaves the mark and also the fact that mud had piled up around Linda's body, showing how that body had pulled that mud down with a great deal of force.
So when you're talking about the high tide and putting a body in, it would mean that a person who was putting that body in would have to have gotten a bit dirty. Would he have had mud, or he or she have had mud on their clothes at the time?
At the time the body is alleged to have been put in the water, we know that there was still mud exposed on each side of the bank. So whichever side the body was put in, the person would have to be muddy. We also know that it was not just mud, it was more like quicksand. And that was reported by a fisherman the day after, who sank in nearly up to his waist. So we have to understand that whoever put the body in would have been covered in mud. At least their pants would have been very dirty and wet.
So it just doesn't make sense that someone would have put... Kevin would have, if he had done it based on the police confession, he would have had to find a way to get around to the other side of the racecourse, wouldn't he have?
If he had, he would have required a change of clothes, and we know that didn't occur. Or, as you say, he would have had to go to the north side of the river, and neither of which there is any evidence for, either alleged or presented in court.
Martin's analysis of the tidal records particularly the findings that it would have been very unlikely that Linda's body had crossed the river that night, posed enough questions to start investigating. Kevin had given a confession to police, and in that long confession, he told them how he had placed Linda in the river.
Remember, Kevin would have been drinking that night at Tanuba. He was picked up the next day for public drunkenness, and he had been wearing the same clothes since the night before, the night he was supposed to have committed the crime. But nowhere in the confession did he say he'd changed his clothes, and nowhere in the evidence was there any indication his clothes were muddy. Also in that confession, which we'll discuss later in the series, Kevin claimed he'd placed Linda in the water on the Tanuba House side of the river. So that's the south side.
But she was found 2 kilometres downstream on the racecourse side. The only way that would have fit Kevin's version of events, as told to police, is if she had crossed the river that night with the tides.
But the tidal records, which can be trusted, and reports of the scene poured water on that possibility. The long 150-metre line in the mud parallel to the riverbank meant her body had travelled in a straight line parallel to the north side of the bank, the racecourse side.
Which would mean Kevin, who had been drinking, would have had to have made it over at least one of the bridges in Rockhampton with Linda's body. He would have needed a car. And he didn't have one. Nowhere in his confession did he mention leaving Tanuba House with Linda's body. And if you think about it, if you're confessing to police about a rape and a murder, why would you make something like that up? Why wouldn't you just tell the truth? And there were so many other questions.
If Kevin had placed Linda in the water, surely he would have been dirty from the mud. Surely it would have been all over his clothes. And if he had been picked up by the police and thrown in the watch house the day after the crime, why would he stay in Rockhampton for 4 days? Why didn't he flee?
And then there was this. There has never been any DNA evidence tying Kevin to Linda's death.
In fact, the only thing that implicates him is that confession.
That was episode 1 of Curtain, a podcast delving into the 1991 murder of an Aboriginal woman named Linda on the banks of Tanuba or the Fitzroy River in Rockhampton, central Queensland.
Next week, join us, Amy Maguire and Martin Hodgson, as we investigate the scene of the crime, Tanuba House, and walk you along the banks of the river, weighted down by a history of bloody memories.
For now, you can catch up on iTunes by typing in Curtain the Podcast or go to our website, www.curtainthepodcast.com.
Also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Curtain the Podcast.